Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lane.
Joining me on the podcast today from Philadelphia is Josh Weidman. Josh owned a property management company, and in part of owning that property management company, he had access to a lot of leases, and he analyzed over 4,000 leases, and he figured out what makes somebody successful in owning rental properties and what makes someone not successful. And he's kind of organized everything here, and we're going to walk through this and figure out what it takes to be successful as a rental property owner. Josh, welcome to the show. I always like to start with hearing a little bit of your background. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in real estate?
First of all, thanks for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here. I got started in real estate in December of 2006, kind of by accident, actually. I had a failed construction company, and I knew that I always wanted to get involved in real estate. And at 18, I bought the Carlton Sheets No Money Down system, and I was really kind of enamored by that until I put it in the back of my closet for 15 years. But at one point, I found myself selling water purifiers on door-to-door basis in this town in New Jersey, and realized that it's not really what I wanted to do. I wasn't making much money. I figured I could go broke doing something that I, might like doing. So I figured I'd give real estate a shot and investing a shot. And I kind of fell backwards into wholesaling, made $30,000 on my first wholesale deal. And it was a springboard to the rest of my real estate career. From there, I built a wholesale company. We were doing anywhere from like 5 to 10 properties on a monthly basis, assigning 5 to 10 contracts on a monthly basis, and did that for several years and started to build a rental portfolio. And then at one point, I realized that this rental business was taking an awful lot of time, and I didn't seem to be doing it right. You always see on TV or the gurus talking about all you have to do is you buy a house, put some paint and carpet up and throw a tenant in there, and then they pay.
Right.
And that wasn't what was happening to me. So, I hired a property manager and fired them, hired another one, fired them, and then realized, I own these properties with a partner of mine. We kind of realized, look, this isn't really working. Let's figure out how to do this ourselves, and make it, basically monetize it, make it an income stream. So we started with our units and 26 units from a friend of ours, and we started our own property management company. And from 2010 until last fall, fall of 2016, we built that management company from that first 20 some odd units up to 638 units. And we ended up selling the management company last September. So, that was a really big learning experience, and it was pretty interesting. It was a very interesting insight into a lot of different avenues of the real estate business.
Now for your rentals, are they all kind of in the same area?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, they're within the same city.
Okay.
But what I've tried to do is buy the same types of properties. When I say types, I'm talking more about like the types of locations and the same asset class.
Mm-hmm.
They're spattered throughout the city. But I know Philadelphia a lot. I spend a lot of time in the city, and it's an area I'm really comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, the difference between being in South Philadelphia or Northeast Philly or West Oak Lane, it's not much different. We're trying to attract the same type of tenants. And, and because of that, it really becomes kind of a cookie cutter model.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into kind of the main topic today, these seven things that if you follow these guidelines, you're probably going to be successful. Now, the first one is a high rent-to-value ratio. Now, this is an interesting topic, but before we get into what exactly that means, for anyone that doesn't know that terminology, can you just explain to us what a rent-to-value ratio is?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So imagine that you have a property that you can buy for $100,000, and you're able to get a tenant that's going to pay you $1,000 a month for that $100,000 property. Well, the rent-to-value ratio is 1 to 100.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's the general concept. Different people are going to categorize that as a different percentage. Some people are looking for like 1.2 or 2%, or, you know, there's different numbers out there. What I'm looking for is something that is, you know, where I can certainly cover my expenses and make, you know, double or triple, you know, 2 or 3% of the purchase price. In addition to that, I mean, it's really important to understand that you can get a really low rent, or a really good rent to value ratio in some of the worst neighborhoods. So that's certainly not the only criteria. You know, it's important to understand that just because something looks good on paper doesn't mean it's going to be good in, you know, in
That's a really good point. And also that number is going to vary from area to area. If you're in New York or Los Angeles trying to find something that's going to meet the 1% rule, it's probably not going to happen. Where in other cities, you might trip over a 2% deal everywhere you go. So is there a good...
That's right.
Is there a good ballpark? Like when I've analyzed deals, if something doesn't meet the 1% rule, it's really hard to make the numbers work. Do you think 1% is a good floor, that if something doesn't meet the 1% rule, that maybe you shouldn't even consider it?
Well, you know, you bring up something pretty interesting here, and that is that people have to, they've got to look at each investment and see if it fits in their own model. I have clients right now that they're just looking for a place to park money that gives them some returns. And one of my business associates, he has a high-end condo business, and he's selling these condos to investors all over the country that are really high net worth for $300,000 or $400,000, and they're getting like 1% cash on cash return after their expenses and things like that. It's abysmal.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, If for some of the neighborhoods that we're looking at, like I said, you're looking at 2 or 3% rent of value to, you know, almost below zero. So as a rule of thumb, I think it's very difficult to give a blanket statement like that.
Yeah.
It's more so, I think you've got to depend on what your objectives are for the investment. You know, if you're looking to park money and just stay ahead of inflation, that's one thing. If you're looking for cash flow, that's another. And if you're looking for appreciation as your major goal, that's a third option.
Right. Okay. So say for someone that's looking for cash flow, like if you're not getting that 1%, like can you really make it work? Like, can you really make the numbers work on a rental?
Well, that comes back to, can you? It's going to be tough.
Yeah.
But I mean, that brings us to the next factor here is, you know, really the taxes, right?
Yeah.
That's a really big contributor.
That's your number two thing. So low taxes. So this is an important thing to look at, because even in the same city, there might be some areas where the taxes are $500, where in another neighborhood, maybe the taxes are $2,000. So trying to find those lower tax areas is really important, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you can imagine taxes as a mortgage that never goes away.
Right.
You know, and so once taxes go up, they're not coming back down. It's important to find a place where the tax rates are going to be, under control enough that you're going to be able to buy the thing and still make it cash flow. I mean, at the end of the day, I have a right in my backyard, there's a certain neighborhood that I would love to buy properties in. The problem is that they will never cash flow. The taxes are so high in the neighborhood, even though it's more of a rental would be a better rental grade area than anything else.
Right.
It just ends up being, you know, off limits because of the taxes. They're $4,000 a year for a $100,000 property. Whereas, you know, you go inside of the city and now we're talking about $1,200 for, you know, for that same $100,000 property.
Now, is there a trade-off that maybe in general, a lower tax area is going to be maybe not such a nice area? Maybe the schools aren't as good or maybe there's trade-offs?
Well, of course, you're going to see that. Yeah, I mean, I'm attracted to more high density areas, more urban areas, and in those areas, you're going to Philadelphia is a great example. The school system in Philadelphia is not so great, but it's not like the school system in South Philadelphia versus West Philadelphia is so much worse in one neighborhood or the other. You're pretty much comparing apples to apples.
Okay.
But when you do leave those more densely populated areas and there's a smaller tax base, I mean, yes, the bills still have to get paid. And so the taxes are probably going to be higher.
Right.
So
okay.
You're right. There is a trade-off there. But, ultimately, you're going to be dealing with a very, very similar populace, you know, in lower tax areas, as long as you're in a fairly dense population.
All right. So making sure your taxes are low is number two. That's a really important thing to look at. The number three thing that you saw that the successful investors weren't leveraging the investment more than 75%. So does that mean that they were putting at least 25% down on every deal?
Not necessarily. They were building an equity as well. I mean, the key to this 25% leverage, or I'm sorry, the 75% leverage, is that it gives you a really good return on your investment, you know, and it can increase your investment from say a 10 or 12% cash on cash return to 20 or 30%. But what it also does is it protects you from downturns because you know if you've been in real estate any length of time, you're going to see the ups and downs of the market. 25% equity in that property minimally is going to be a good spot to be in.
Yeah.
You know, it's a range to be.
Yeah. Does give you a little bit of protection. I was talking to someone the other day that was telling me that during the recession, his rents dropped 20%. So like having that buffer is important because that could take a cash flowing property into to a liability every month. All right. So
that's exactly right. Yep.
So number four is having immediate equity. So that's
right.
Buying properties, right? Buying them below market value. Is there a certain ballpark that you generally try to look for?
Well, in our market, I mean, my target on my investments are the after repair values. We're looking at anywhere from about $85,000 to $125,000. That's my target for a rental property. And so when I'm looking at those properties, two evaluations. One is on the fair market value of that property, you know, whatever of the two gives me the lowest value. That's my all-in number. So generally speaking, I'm looking at least half $20,000 in equity in each of my properties. And so, you know, in a $85,000 house, that's closer to 25% on a, you know, $120,000 house. What is that? Something more like 20% or 18%. But all in all, as I look at these properties, I want to have enough equity that if I have to liquidate, because, you know, for good or bad, sometimes life throws us some curveballs and we need cash or we got to get out of an investment or maybe a partnership doesn't work out and you've got real estate involved. So you got to liquidate these things. You don't want to have to reach in your pocket and lose money, even in an emergency. And so that's why I think equity is so important.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Okay. All right. Number five is keeping your maintenance expenses low. How can you do that? Are you maybe trying to find places that are in good shape or maybe doing rehabs before you put the property in service?
Yeah. So this is one thing that really jumped out at me as an underlying of all of the investors that I was looking at is it, I'll give you a perfect example. This is a little bit of an aside, but I had this client, he was a plumber and he had a hard time reading our statements. So we ended up spending a good amount of time on the phone and in person with each other every month. And, you know, it always amazed me because I would look at his properties and they didn't look very special or beautiful or even all that updated. But what they did was function. You know, all of the mechanicals on the house were really sound. The toilets flushed, the heat went on when it was cold, the windows opened and closed properly, the doors did the same, and there was really never any maintenance calls. And you know, I asked him one time, well, what's the point here? What's going on? He said, well, look at my tenant history. And you would look back and nobody complained. Everybody wanted to stay as long as possible in his houses. And really, you know, it was so beneficial to him to put a little bit of extra money in up front. And so I stole that with my rentals. And I said, you know what, I'm going to renovate it when I buy the property. And what it allowed me to do was put a whole new view on my buying criteria. So I started buying properties that were in worse condition, but I'd pay significantly less for them so that mm-hmm. I could go in and I had the budget to go in and renovate anything that, I mean, at this point, I go into a property and anything that doesn't have a 10-year lifespan, I'm getting rid of. And sometimes that means a, you know, an 8-year-old roof that has another, you know, 7 years on it. Sorry, it's not 10 years. The idea behind it is that if I build in the cost up front, there's going to be no surprises. And even when there is a small maintenance issue, it's small. Right. And, you know, I also try to make sure that when we're doing the renovations on these properties, we're being forward thinking in the types of materials and products that we're putting in there. I get rid of all the moving parts in my apartments. So, you know, I don't have any ceiling fans. There's no garbage disposals or dishwashers. There's no washer dryers. And I know that there are plenty of landlords who would disagree with me on this, but I try to offset the absence of these options by putting some upgrades in the cosmetics on the property and putting in some products that look really fantastic and make my units look better than everything else out there. And it's paid off. I mean, we have long-staying tenants and low maintenance.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. I mean, you're lowering your expenses and then your tenants are happier because some of those things you mentioned are the kind of things that they're going to drive most of your calls. So getting rid of the garbage disposal and the dishwasher is, I think, really smart. All right. And number six is good tenants. So how are you screening to make sure that your tenants are good?
All right. I look at tenant screening like a three-legged stool. And if you can imagine this, you know, you've got the little flat part of the stool that you sit on, and then you've got these three legs that come out on the bottom of the stool. Well, if you take one of those legs and it breaks, you know, you can probably put a box or a book or something up underneath that stool, and it'll still work. But if you have two legs that break, I mean, that thing is just going to fall over.
Right.
And obviously, three legs are the best. My three legs are the credit and background of the tenant, the income. And by the way, documentable income. And then the third is their prior rental history. And so I'm digging into these three things. And basically, I'm looking for three times the monthly rent. I'm looking as an income level. I'm looking for at least a decent credit score. I mean, like 620 to 650 is pretty decent in my market. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm comfortable with there. But I also am looking at the content of the credit as much as the actual score to see if there's, you know, if they're not paying their car payment and they've got some repossessions there, that's probably not a good sign. You know, they're not paying their credit cards or their lease. There's certain indicators that I look for. But then really the biggest tell for me is that prior landlord history. If they haven't given notice at their current residence that they're leaving and they're ready to sign the lease with you, that's the problem.
Yeah, totally.
You know, just little things like that. If they don't have anything good to say about their current landlord, it's probably them.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
What about, what about someone with a prior eviction? Would you ever rent to them?
I have, in fact.
Okay.
It's important. I mean, I have a list of what do they call it? Basically, it's a blacklist that any of these things, you know, or an automatic denial on the tenant. And that it, most of that includes like violent crime or crimes involving kids or animals and just things of, that you don't necessarily want to deal with as a landlord. But you know, when it comes to evictions, there are some reasons why people get evicted, because in a lot of cases, you're looking at a landlord tenant filing. It could be because of a non-payment of rent. It could be, especially recently, I've been coming across a lot of evictions by banks for tenants that lived in the property and they're paying rent to the landlord who's being foreclosed on. They end up in a situation where, you know, the bank's got to do what they got to do, but it's not like it's a bad tenant.
Right. It's not their fault. Right.
Well, exactly. Those are real reasons. Most of the time, though, an eviction means no.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. So you got to look at it, but there could be reasons that you would accept someone with an eviction.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best tenants I've ever had, she had a heart surgery, open heart surgery, and it was, you know, obviously an emergency type situation. And when that happened, she was in the hospital for over a month. And when she got out, she was in eviction. When I rented to her, she was currently living in the same property 2 years after the eviction filing, and her landlord gave her a glowing recommendation. So, I mean, that's really the exception to the rule as opposed to the rule itself.
Right.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then the seventh and final thing is active management. Now, how do you be an active manager? Because I know a lot of times, if the tenant is paying their rent every month and they're not calling you that something's broken, there might not be a whole lot to do. How do you stay engaged with the tenant?
Well, there's a couple things that are important. I mean, we implemented a handful of things with our property management company that prevented problems when tenants initially moved in. Because usually, if you can get them settled in the house and paying rent, that's the easy part. You know, that's the hard part. Everything else is easy. Because usually you have hiccups when they move in, and if you can address those very quickly, it's a great situation. If you don't, they can turn into big problems and then blossom into an eviction type situation if they're left unchecked.
Right.
But in general, we do a couple things. First and foremost is very aggressive collections. And what I do with that is on the 20th of an invoice, and on the invoice it just says how much is due and if there's a back balance, and it's like a mortgage payment. By the day before the first of the month, they'll get an automated robocall that just says, hey, this is your landlord, your rent's due tomorrow. Just wanted to give you a friendly reminder. And then they get the same thing on the 5th of the month, which is the day before a late fee is assessed. And so, you know, it's just this kind of constant upkeep and letting them know that, hey, we're expecting you to perform on this. We're aware of whether you paid your rent or not. And, it kept our collection rates somewhere north of 90%. It was like 93.7% or something like that during the last year of management. That was with over 600 units.
That's great.
It was really good stuff. But the other thing that we tried to do was to make sure that we picked the right tenant. I've had tenants that, they got a 750 credit score, great income, everything checks out, and then they move in to the apartment or the house and they never pay rent again. It's like, what did I miss?
Right.
And, you know, so what we will do after the tenant moves in, or actually at the lease signing, is we're going to schedule a 1 month follow-up where we do an inspection on the house, just to kind of get an idea of how they live and make sure that the people that are on the lease are the people that are actually living there. We present it as an opportunity for them to voice any concerns that they have on the house or any issues that might have come up. And sometimes it turns into a little bit of a maintenance thing, but more often than not, it gives us an alert of, this person is going to be a problem. They trash the place in the first 30 days. Let's take an action to get the collection and get them out of the house.
Well, I think that's great. So just to review, so the seven things to make sure you're doing is to have a high rent to value ratio, find an area with low taxes. The maximum leverage you want to use is 75%. Buy a property with immediate equity. make sure that you control your maintenance expenses, you find good tenants, and you have active management. So I think that that's good. I think that's a good checklist to go by. Josh, if so why don't you tell us what you're doing today? So you own a turnkey property company. Well, why don't you tell us how that works and how one of our listeners could learn more about it?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So the name of my company is Turnkey Philly. We offer turnkey investments in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We have 21 different specific neighborhoods that meet our target zone and our criteria that we invest in. And, you know, our clients, basically, they come to us and they're professionals. Sometimes they're out of state, out of the country. They're coming from areas where they've got very high values and it's in property value. So it's really hard to find that cash flow and the rent rate. So basically what we do is we do an initial interview to kind of explain the details of our program. And, from there we kind of see if we're a match. And then we'll go out and pair the investment with the investor, on a one-to-one basis. And, review the investment. If it works for them, then we sell them the property. Do a comprehensive renovation on the building, go in and place a tenant, and then turn it over to management. I mean, we still work with the same company that we ended up selling my property management company to. My partner Ian runs the portfolio over there, so you know it's the same processes that we initially set up, and it's just happens to be down the hall in our building as opposed to right in my office.
Okay, now tell me the price ranges that you're working in. Like, what would a typical turnkey property cost?
That's great. Great question. So one of the staples of our investments is that there's at least $20,000 in equity in these properties. So our target range is about an $85,000 to $125,000 after repair value or appraised value. And that puts our investor all in on these houses somewhere between about $65,000 and about $105,000, depending on the investment. We analyze the properties so that on a, if you're all in, they're all in cash on these things, you're going to see about a 10 to 15% cash on cash return. And then once the leverage is applied, you're going to see much higher than that. It's usually between 20 and 30%.
Great. Well, that sounds great. Well, why don't you give us some, if someone wanted to research you a little bit more, give us your website and how someone could contact you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. If you go to our website, it's Turnkey Philly, and that's Philly, turnkeyphilly.com. There's, we've got some testimonials there. We have a couple case studies of properties as well as, a little overview of how the process works, some information about Philadelphia. If you're looking to reach out and contact us, you can actually schedule an appointment on the website to do a private call. Or if you'd like to reach out to the office, you can reach us at 267-507-7055. So again, the website is turnkeyphilly.com and our phone number is 267-507-7055.
Awesome. Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And thank you for listening. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.